Set down your sleepy water and your Mr. Whistle. Take off that raincoat and grab a cold beer. It's time to have a real talk about pediatric dentistry. You're listening to Bruise and Tiny Teeth, the unfiltered pediatric dentistry podcast.
Brandon, thanks for hopping on the podcast. I was just going to kick us off for the sake of time because I know, I think you got a patient. Do you have patients today? Are you in the office today?
I have an admin day, so I'm headed to do performance reviews after this. So you know
how that goes. Yeah. I do know how that goes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Today's been busy. This summer's been pretty bumping. Got a lot of sedations and stuff. So I got a quick lunch break. I wanted to get on and chat and meet you, but I appreciate you taking some time to hop on and chat with me. I know you and I kind of got linked up sort of out of the blue, and we were having a conversation on like some commercial real estate topics that I wanted to touch on today, but I figured we'd start maybe big picture. I kind of wanted to learn a little bit more about your practice. And I was kind of looking, it sounds like you're over on the West Coast maybe we're really involved in some American Board of Pediatric Dentistry, which shout out, I'm board certified now. So we could chat about cheers. That a little bit. That's yeah. Great. Cheers to that. But yeah, tell me about your background in peds and where you went to dental school and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So I went to Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon, and then looking to get as far away from that as possible. I went to South Carolina for my pediatric training and then homesick for back to the Northwest and came back here to Portland. And I've been here since 2003, opened up a startup practice in 2004. Been kind of bumping along ever since. Started as just me, and then my wife's a general dentist. She joined the practice, and we just hired an associate about 6 months ago, which has been a little bit nerve-wracking at first because you don't know what's up ahead, but it's been marvelous. So
yeah. Okay, cool. So did you you're in Portland, did you associate at all when you came back, or did you get done with residency and just say I'm going to start up right away?
Yeah, I did associate. I met up with a former instructor and worked for her for about a year and a half and realized that I wanted to do my own thing. She has a great practice, but I just wanted to kind of, you know, set things up the way you want to set them up, and did that. And it's been great. You know, it's always a new struggle every day, or different things every day, as anyone who owns a practice knows, but it's been super. Okay. And then the real estate thing kind of propped up kind of unannounced and kind of off to the races with that.
Okay. Well, give me some background about like what this startup journey looked like. So this was a scratch start. It was 2003. So this was, I mean, you've been at this game for a while, but this was like pre housing crisis, great financial recession and all that. You know, did you lease out a space and just kind of start like a few days a week with a few patients and kind of grow? Like what kind of demographics, like in that area were you working with? Like what did this practice look like that first couple years you got going?
Yeah. Well, as anyone knows with a scratch practice, it's real slow at first and you're just trying to meet as many people as possible. So like my first day I had two patients, the second day I had three and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I moved out, I started a practice in the kind of suburbs of Portland. And at the time, this is how dated I am. Google Maps wasn't really functioning at that time. So I literally MapQuested out a map and kind of put pins on paper where all the pediatric dentists were and just look for a hole. Mm-hmm. And then leased out a space and thinking that was going to be my forever future, and did a 10-year lease with options to renew and negotiated as much as you kind of think you can. But reality, like as anyone knows who leased out a space, you're just kind of asking for whatever you can, but they just ultimately decide what you end up getting. Mm-hmm. And they had it was a orthodontist who built the shell. And then, so the slab wasn't poured yet. So I was able to kind of lay my plumbing and that kind of stuff. And then was there from 2004 up through, I guess, 2011. And then decided to move after that when the land next to me came for sale.
Okay. So, did you outgrow the space? Like, was that part of the problem, was you physically didn't have enough space to practice out of?
Yeah, that's a good question. It wasn't that. I was definitely growing into the space. I had two quiet rooms and then three hygiene bay chairs, and just me at that time, no other dentists. And I was definitely busy in filling that space, but I didn't feel I had one more operatory to build out at that time, kind of a smaller one. And so I wasn't really like bursting at the seams. Medicaid reimbursements in Oregon are pretty substantially lower than a lot of parts of the country. So I really couldn't make my numbers work out by taking Medicaid. So, didn't do that. So that kind of limited my patient base to kind of draw from.
Right.
But I wanted a comfortable office too, not just one going a million miles an hour. So what happened was I was just going to work one day and I get a little flyer on the door that the guy who owned the land, a third of an acre land in front of my office, said, "I'm selling. I'm talking to all the tenants nearby." Turned out he was just talking to the dentists. And if you want, and I went to my wife and I said, "Look, at that time, we were only what, 5-6 years in. We get most of our new patients from our signage, like it's because it was on a busy road. And it's like, if they put like a Kentucky Fried Chicken and just block everything, like my new patients are going to dry up." So almost like a defensive maneuver, I decided to open up or to pursue buying the land, the raw land, and demoing a tiny little building and then building an office.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know a lot about Portland, but when I think of Portland, I think of expensive. I've never been out to Portland before, so you'll have to teach me about it. But you said this was what, 2011 when you did this?
Yeah. That's when the land became for sale at that time in 2011.
Okay. What, if you don't mind, like what did the price point look like? There's obviously an existing building, I think you said, but you know, don't they sell ground for like an astronomical amount per square foot? Maybe that's a new thing, but was that the case at the time?
Fortunately not. We were out. There is in the a lot of areas on the West Coast, Portland included, there's a really strict urban growth boundary, which allows for, you know, agriculture and wineries and that kind of thing to develop, but it really makes the land more expensive inside. But it hadn't really got to Bonkersville in terms of cost back then, fortunately. And so at the time, it wasn't like a super price shock. So I dug up the numbers before this talk here, and I paid $279K for a third of an acre, which was probably a premium back then. And what happened was, and this is the banks kind of freaked out on me at first about this when I first opened up the office in that same, because it was next door neighbors to me at that time. I'm in the middle of a retirement community. So you have to be 55 even to buy a home in that area. And so people were real skeptical about my business plan at first, but also there's a zillion kids around just outside of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you started, cause this was kind of a surprise thing, it sounds like, but you know, the lending side of things, I'm always really interested by, cause everybody's got a different way of going about this, but did you go and get approved for this loan? You convinced the bank, you got funding. Was this like a 0% down SBA loan? Or I guess first question, how did the lending work for that? And then did you sit on this land for a period of time prior to building?
Yeah. So, as is most cases for us dentists, like we're consider ourselves experienced after one encounter like this. So I've done literally this one time. So I had no idea what I was doing and talked to as many people as possible. And the way it all kind of played out was I had enough cash on hand to put a down payment. It wasn't 0% for the land. Mm-hmm. And unlike a residential kind of transaction that we're all familiar with, the contract time was really long. It was like 3 months. And apparently that's common. Again, I'm no expert on this, but because we have to do feasibility studies in terms of survey, you have to meet the community, make sure that the zoning's okay, and you know, all those kind of things. And so it took 3 months just to do the land deal. And then it took several months to then in terms of paying for plans and architects and designers and all that stuff before we broke ground. So we ended up actually moving in the spring of 2013. So it took about 18 months start to finish looking at the land to actually moving in, and made plenty of mistakes and things I'm happy with along the way, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Are they able to group that into one loan? You know, if you've got, you probably started a separate business entity or an LLC for the real estate. Mm-hmm. Did you buy the land under that entity? And then were you able to roll that into the same loan when you built the building, or was it two separate things? Like, how does that get structured?
Yeah. I didn't know what options were, but fortunately I was able to kind of connect with folks and give me some guidance on this. So I bought the land personally at first, and then folded it into an LLC that then incorporated the land and the building as that was built. And so you started a new bank account and that kind of stuff, and just allowed just to have that separate entity that you can eventually rent from and, you know, gotcha, hold on to after you sell your practice.
Cool. Yeah. Keep a clean set of books.
So one loan total for both the land, the building shell, and the build out inside was cool. All wrapped up into one. And it was a, I think it was a 10-year loan, non-amortizing, so it didn't go to zero, which is, I guess, common for construction loans. And it was a 5-year prepayment penalty at that time, which I ended up refinancing after 5 years.
Okay. You know, this is a sidebar question. If I step back again, I just watched a couple documentaries on the 08 housing crisis, but I just still trying to paint the picture that this is back in 2011. You were around back when, you know, when interest rates were a different thing. You know, you kind of probably locked in at a pretty low interest rate, but this was post 2008 housing crisis. What was the environment like in pediatric dentistry during all of that? I was in high school at the time. And so this is a really random question, but I'm curious, you know, did it seem like pediatric dentistry was fairly recession resistant, if you're not seeing Medicaid, if you're seeing Medicaid, it kind of makes sense that it would be, but what was kind of your experience being a practice owner, you know, during that chunk of time, I guess?
So what I found, so, you know, picture 2008, everything's going good. And then the floor drops out. And if anyone's unfamiliar with that, I would encourage them to kind of look that up, because literally it seemed like everyone lost their jobs and no one had any money and people were losing their houses and all kinds of crazy stuff. The phones definitely stopped ringing to some degree. But that said, every time I went to my study club, and I have a study club that I go to, a Seattle type study club, that there were general dentists and surgeons and periodontists and orthodontists. And pretty much everyone just looked at me and said, "You're the only one here who has patients," because no one else had new patients. And so I think pedo was affected the least back then. And it wasn't the low, even directly after that, even though they cut interest rates, they weren't nearly as low as they were, you know, 2 years ago. So I think my construction loan was around 6%. And then, you know, with all that, and then I refinanced, for a 15 year at 3.4%. And then they did a rate reduction later, to 3.8 in 2020. And then, you know, they got me. And one thing that apparently is common, but chalk it up to the many things I didn't know going into this. In order to be considered for a larger loan like this, and back then it was a lot, but these days it's not as much. I think it was probably close to $1.2 million in terms of my total loan for everything. They require you, as long as you hold the note, to put all of your deposits in with that bank. So whatever bank you go with, you had to do that. So they're essentially loaning your own money back to yourself. But then that reduces your ability to move your money to keep up with inflation too. So I'm still struggling with that a little bit.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I'm the same way. I don't own any real estate, but my practice loan is through Wells Fargo. Same thing. They make you bank with them. You got to keep your business accounts with them. I thought that all sounded fine and dandy until I found out that there is not a brick and mortar Wells Fargo in the entire state of Missouri where I practice.
Oh, awesome.
And so I have to mobile deposit every single check that comes through the door, and they limit it. Like, you can only do up to like 125 grand a month in like insurance checks, which is a good problem to have. But most months we go over that. So about once a month, I either have to do certified mail, or I've got to drive to like Iowa or Illinois or send somebody with a big stack of checks to deposit it. So it's a huge pain in the ass. Like, I've worked on it forever, but as soon as I pay that loan, I'm done. I'm out of there. Like, I'm going to find a local bank, 'cause I'm over it. It's tough.
How do you do a cash deposits? You have to do the same?
Well, for cash deposits, I have a bank that, like, a local bank across the street that I use, but there's fees and so much headache with doing wire transfers every time I have to do that, when I looked into it, it wasn't super practical to take all those checks to the local bank and then wire the money to Wells Fargo all the time. Like, I looked into it, there was fees associated with it. And I'm like, well, that's a pain in the ass. So it was a lose-lose. The best way to do it is certified mail, where I pre-write out all the slips, everything's stamped. I put it in like certified mail so I can track it, and I mail it to the nearest branch. And that seems to work out best. But it's just, it's something that, like, lesson learned for anybody trying to do a startup. If you're going to do lending, it might be something to consider. If there's two banks that are kind of equal, make sure if there's one that has a local brick and mortar center nearby, that can be a benefit.
Yeah. And one thing that, just because I just knew that whatever rate I was locked in at was going to have some pretty major implications for years and years, right, to come for this. And so I went to, there's kind of some major players in the area here. But I went to two major banks in the area that I knew did a lot of dental lending. I didn't mention that I was going to with other, I wasn't getting basically bids. And just like when you did your own startup, you know how much information they need. I mean, they need, and for a building startup, they need somehow even more. And so you had to just pretty pour your guts out, and probably took me, I mean, no joke, 40 hours each or more, each application, just to fill it all out. And then I had essentially two offers, two different interest rates. And I went, just like you would do for any kind of supply, you know, supplier, if they're offering a dental chair, you know, can you beat, you know, bank A versus bank B? And shockingly, they were like really upset. They thought that was like somehow like insulting to them. I'm like, dude, this is a transaction. You gotta sharpen your pencils, boys. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, but I think they look at my own personal kind of bias on this. I think that a lot of lenders, especially small ones, look at dentists like we're prey, like we're kind of unsophisticated when it comes to financial products, and they're going to switch things around on us. And just being skeptical is not being rude, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know? I think it's a good point. Yeah. So Brandon, give me a, you know, if we flash forward to you building this building, took you 18 months. How did you give, tell me a little bit about the building itself. How many square feet did you put in there? Is it all your own dental space, or do you have other tenants in the building? Size, number of ops, just kind of paint the picture of this building that you built for yourself.
Yeah. So talking to like financial advisors and stuff, they really said, you're going to get the best bang for your buck if you put the biggest building you can fit on this land. And it just happened to be a dental office size piece of land. And it's 3,800 square feet is the size of the whole place. I put in 15 parking spots. And I wanted to make sure I didn't want to have to redo the paint. So it's like a brick facade, and I have 8 operatories. So 2 close ops on either side. So 4 total. I have a hygiene bays in the middle, but I got these barn doors. Anyone can reach out to me and I can give you the photos or specs to these, but there's these like acrylic doors you can kind of, that are look really nice, that you kind of move back and forth. And that allows essentially a hygiene bay room to turn into a single room for like cool. Single patients and stuff. So we can accommodate large families and then also close things up, and it keeps the noise level down. Mm-hmm. And so we pretty much have 2 doctors working at once at that time. Wasn't again the plan, just kind of worked out that way. We have kind of the older kid side and the younger kid side on the other side right there. And then some ortho in the middle.
That kind of was fortunate, you know, when COVID hit, you know, your financial crisis was my COVID, you know, for my time period. Right. But, you know, that's smart. Like a lot of us, myself included, the whole big, like 4-chair, 6-chair, big open hygiene area is a bit dated now post COVID, where it's nice to have some option, even something retractable. Even like we installed a big solar shade that I hit a button and my electrician installed it. So if we have a fam of 4, we can line everybody up. But if we have a couple families separate, then you just hit a button and a big like solar shade drops down, which it sounds like it's kind of a similar vibe to like your barn door. But like that's anybody that's like building an office now, I always give them that little piece of advice is like keep the option to close things off, because you still get those parents that like to have that like kind of seclusion and privacy a bit. So that's a smart idea.
Totally agree. Yeah. I still have patients coming in, parents coming in with N95s, face shields, and big gloves. And so people have a wide range of what they're comfortable for them, you know, and I think they always will.
Yeah. That's maybe a little bit of a Portland thing. I can't say in rural Missouri, I don't see it as much, but that's okay. So tell me about, you know, with the build out, we talked about how there were some like tax implications, and this is like something I'm interested in because I don't know a lot about it. And so you maybe just be able to speak to your experience on this, but did you have a conversation with whoever you use for a financial advisor, whether it's dental specific or not, with like your accountant and CPA? Did you have a discussion about like, okay, if you take out, you know, you buy the land and the building and it's a $1.2 million loan, we can depreciate this, and this over this many years and have this amount of tax write-offs. I was hoping you could maybe expand on like how you did the math and like, you know, kind of the thought that went into the tax implications. With the secondary question that I'll throw in there is like when people are always asking, should I build a practice right away? One of the things that I tell them not having built one yet is like, sometimes you need those tax breaks later on once you're established and you've got a lot more taxable income. Whereas maybe those first few years you're starting out, you're not as busy, but I know at this point you are 6-7 years into your practice. So obviously like you're in your more of your peak working years. So I'm guessing that factored into it, but I was hoping you could maybe just kind of like shed some light on the discussions on the tax side of things that you maybe had with your CPA prior to making this jump.
Yeah. And I started with a dental CPA, and because they often are a little bit more expensive, I ended up moving away from them, just getting a more standard one. And then I immediately regretted that after trying two of them, came back to the dental folks, and they really gave me some good guidance on things about what it looks like from a cash flow perspective, you know, now or the first 5 years, and then what the last 10 years looks like. And from like a tax perspective, there's kind of two kind of main topics. One, you can't depreciate the paint, for instance. The first coat of paint's a 20-year depreciating thing, which is bonkers. But every subsequent coat, you can then depreciate over 1 year. And like, paint's expensive, as you found out, right? Things like the sidewalk is, again, also like a 20-year one or 30-year one. It's really long. But they do I think buildouts do this too, a cost segregation analysis, where they pretty much say, this is dental, this is not dental, you know, the plumbing and whatnot. And they can accelerate depreciation for that. But the second thing, which I think is, again, I had to be kind of instructed on this when I was initially looking at this, is that, and I'm 100% owner occupied, so there's no other tenants in my building. Mm-hmm. So now that I'm, you know, 10 years after building the office, the, you know, everything's kind of humming along, nothing's knock on wood breaking yet. And so my pay my rent and comes out of the practice. And of course that's principal and interest. And it's a kind of a unique thing where you can take an asset, in this case, a building, and take untaxed dollars, which essentially the profit off of your business after your practice, and pay down a loan, both principal and interest. Anything else, if I were to go buy another business, unless I merged those businesses, I would have to take profit out, pay the taxes, and then pay the loan on that other asset with already tax dollars. Mm-hmm. So, and the way the math works out, I mean, my rent to myself is around $9,000 a month. And so that means that by the time this is paid off in 2032, that's going to be a cash generating asset for me, which is kind of the definition, I guess, of a retirement vehicle to some degree. Now that said, I'm going to have to pay, because it's depreciating when I sell it, because that'll have to happen hopefully someday. I have to pay capital gains on that, just like any other long-term asset too. But I have no financial affiliation with this, but I prescribe to the Blair McGill Report. They're just like a dental organization that the CPAs that I'm not a client of, but get their newsletter, and they talk a lot about little techniques you can employ at the end of your career to, say, put it into a charitable trust, and then you get like a salary from that that trust, and you then it ends up being given to a charity of your choice, so you don't have to pay that massive tax load at the end. So fortunately, there's a lot of loopholes that are still existing in the tax code that you can take advantage of when the time comes, but being able to pay off an asset with untaxed dollars is a pretty big one.
Gotcha. So let me just, I want to reflect this and make sure I understand it properly, because this has taken me a while to understand. So I'll say this, and then you can say that, yeah, I'm thinking of this correctly, or vice versa. So, mm-hmm. you know, you are paying rent through your practice, which is its own legal entity. And that's obviously like a deductible expense, you know, business expense. So that's yes. a write-off, whatever your $9,000 in rent is. So you take that check every month and you send it to your other parent company that owns the building. And that's its own different separate business. And in that business, that rent is treated like top line income. You know, it's income coming off. And then just like your dental practice, the building also has other expenses, you know, repairs expenses, you know, just like a normal profit and loss would be on that building. So, you know, and one of the expenses being deductible interest, because, you know, anytime you're paying interest on a loan, that's a deductible expense. So in right. theory, your real estate company that owns the building would have like profits that would be taxed. But because of the depreciation of, you know, the cost segregation and all of this accelerated depreciation you're taking over the first so many years, that depreciation is what lowers that basis, where like it brings it down. So you have zero actual taxable income? Because I guess my question is, like, wouldn't, you know, you taking the rent from your the rent from your practice and moving it to the building, it would just move it to a different business and you'd be taxed on the you know, taxed on that, on those dollars on the business side, because principal pay down is normally taxed. But the way you get around this is you're able to, like, cost segregate, you know, depreciate everything and lower that taxable income on that particular business to go to zero, so you don't have pay taxes on it. I might have done a bad job explaining that, but, like, am I thinking about that correctly?
I think you are, yes. And that's why the CPA also has us just make the rent be really close to what our current expenses are, so the profit really is pretty low. Okay. So what you're being taxed on aside from the principal is really modest. And with that, they're still depreciating, you know, process that way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's right. So okay. you have to dial in. And in fact, I even reached out to my CPA this last week, said, hey, I'm looking, and I'm not looking to retire. I'm 20 years into this, but I probably have to, like, get my kids through college and, you know, make all that kind of business. So should I start making the rents higher? Because that'll make essentially my building more valuable. And I can, you know, eventually sell it for a lot more if there's a long history of it. They said, well, in the next 5 years, it's not a big deal. So we're just going to keep it low for that reason. But you're able to, because you have another business entity in addition to your practice, you can do little tricks, and I'm no CPA, talk to your own CPA, all that disclaimer, but you can have a shareholders meeting in, you know, the Bermuda or Hawaii or whatever. And that's a taxable, that's a write-off towards the profits of that. And sit just like your practice, or if you have a vacation home, you can rent, you know, 2 weeks a year out of both for the both of those entities, one each at least for that. So it's good to have an additional business entity, just like having a practice.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and I guess, like, looking long term, you know, that this is harnessing my inner, like, Robert Kiyosaki, like, rich dad, poor dad, like, very pro commercial real estate mindset, because I have a lot of buddies that are really into this. But, you know, you think long term, like, what can you do? There's always that big debate. What do you do with the building when you own it? You get the category of dentist that it's like, we're going to keep this as part of my retirement plan, so I have good cash flow in retirement. And then you have a lot of other dentists that are like, I don't want anything to do. I don't want to get a phone call. I want nothing. I want to sell everything, the practice and the building, and move. And then you have to deal with capital gains and that whole conversation. But I always find that to be kind of an interesting debate on the, you know, do you like hold on to that asset and keep the cash flow and deal with a little bit of headache, or do you just sell and pay the capital gains and be done with it? Cause I know a lot of, like, really super ultra wealthy people build a lot of that generational wealth by, like, holding on to those assets. And then they either 1031 exchange them when they die, or when they sell it and buy a different piece of commercial real estate, or they just die and leave it all to their kids on the step up basis. Like, so that gets kind of into the weeds of it. But it sounds like you guys are maybe going to keep it as cash flow for a while, but eventually may sell it to whoever the current, like, owners of the practice might be.
Yeah, I don't really see a scenario where the whoever buys the practice, and my current associate's not, that's not something that she's really kind of focused on. And so who knows what the future holds on that, but my financial advisor, separate from my CPA, pretty much said that it works really well for your retirement plan, because you're not going to draw from your 401k until you're 65, 69, whatever that number is. Mm-hmm. So having cash flow during that time is really crucial. So the ideal is to sell the practice on at date X1, and then date X5 or X10 is when you sell the building. So you have a 5 or 10 year time where you're kind of cash flowing things, and then find out if you want to. And I have a colleague, another pediatric dentist, a friend of mine who just retired about 2 years ago, and he took his building 1031'd it to a house in Arizona, and then rented it for a year, and then I don't know how this works, believe me, but backed it out and then turned into his primary home. So kind of avoided the taxes that way. So
all sorts of real estate, like, little, if you know the tax code and the loopholes, you got to be good. This all, maybe the theme of this whole podcast is, like, have a really good team of, like, advisors and CPAs to help you through this, since, you know, our knowledge is limited, you know.
Right. And the only other thing I would add to that is that the commercial, like, development process, in terms of, you know, you have to meet with the neighbors and get approval from the commission, you know, for the city to get, you know, building permits and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The amount of cash that you have to have on hand before the banks will even touch the process I mean, things may have changed in 15 years. I'm not sure. But at that time, they would only give you your first dollar out of that loan once you had the building plans and all of your design work completed, including architectural mock-ups and everything. So I had to have, back in 2011 or 2012, I had to have at least $100,000 in cash just to be able to kind of cash flow it to kind of make it all work. And of course, your CPA then has, you know, due to officer, loan to officer, and then you charge yourself interest and pay yourself back. But that's, it's, you know, cash is king, right? It's always been that way.
Yeah, you kind of answered my question, but I was going to ask, you know, if you've got a lot of dentists that listen or like me, like early in their startup careers and, you know, maybe are leasing off the get, you know, right out of the gate and think it'd be nice to build a building. Eventually, I'm going to outgrow my space. I want to buy that half acre lot and I want to, you know, build a building, but you think it's probably going to be a whole project, a $1.5, $1.7 million project. You know, what's a appropriate amount of cash to be planning to have on hand for when that day comes? But it sounds like at least a solid 10 to 15, you know, to 10, 20% probably wouldn't be a bad idea to have down if at all possible. Sounds like it requires a lot of cash.
Yeah, it just does. And it lets you sleep at night, or you want to make that one decision. Like for instance, when I was towards the tail end of everything, you know, before Portland got its reputation of being what it is, I was worried about graffiti, right? And so if you have a brick place and they film graffiti, yeah, it's hard to get off. Well, you can put a coating over it that will make it easy to remove. And that was like $2,000, and having that in the bank's not going to give you extra money once they know what you're costing. So you have making those decisions when you have cash on hand is really helpful. And if you have and this is where your financial planners kind of come into play. If you have kind of personal savings that are in stocks, you can kind of count that towards your assets to make it the banks like you, but don't have to necessarily touch it. And you can even get like a loan against that for like a bridge loan if you need to without causing a problem. So,
gotcha.
But you know, just talk to as many banks as possible and get good people on your team to make good decisions and all that.
Kind of as we flash forward to like this current point in time, you know, you said you've got, I think, three dentists there. You've got yourself. And then do you have a partner now along with an associate?
So my wife's a general dentist. And so she worked for her sister for a number of years and then decided that it just made more sense for, you know, for every unit of time worked to work inside the practice. And we've done that. And so she sees kids from, which I recommend for business model plan, by the way, she sees kids from like 12 to 26. And I see, you know, the younger ones, I see some teenagers too, but she handles all the second molars. And so does all that. And then another pediatric dentist who works here. And we both, when we had Angela, the associate join our team, we both cut back a day. So now I'm working 3 days plus an admin day and Kat is too. So to allow her to kind of add a couple days and hopefully more in the future.
Cool. I've always thought that's an underutilized business model. That's something I'd be interested at is, you know, it seems like I've talked about this on the podcast before, but like teens and adolescents seem to be a really like underserved demographic in a lot of communities, ours included, where I don't really have a good place to send a lot of those like 16-year-olds that start getting class twos everywhere, need permanent crowns. Like a lot of general dentists don't really need or want to see them because they still may take a little TLC. But yeah, if you could like find a way to incorporate, like have enough space to bring in like a good general dentist, it makes so much sense. Like it's really cool you've been able to make a good business model out of that.
Yeah. And as everyone knows who treats teenagers, like they generally don't floss. Like there's going to be caries, and the average 15 to 17 year old population is going to have plenty. And I think it's actually, and this is kind of a sidebar, I know, but an untreated population, there's plenty of anxiety in the high school kids, and they need help as much as young kids sometimes. So particularly post COVID.
So then you guys just worked, you and your wife, for a number of years, then recently did the jump to having an associate. So, you know, without making it its own whole, that could be a whole separate podcast and conversation, but kind of what are some of the cliff notes? Like, you know, when did you know you were ready for an associate? Sounds like you were kind of wanting to cut back, but what, you know, have there been surprises along the way? What's gone well? Like, just tell me about like bringing on the associate and just in the first little bit, what that journey's been like so far.
Well, among my colleagues here, I've been the most kind of cautious and pessimistic about bringing on an associate. And that's why we all started our own practice to begin with, because we like the way we like things. I really, it was a goal just to spend more time with our kids, really. And we kind of met some financial kind of check marks. And so it's not like we really need to, you know, go full throttle all the time. And what we did in kind of worst case scenario, you know, on the building process, I made a zillion like spreadsheets. I was like the spreadsheet master and constantly kind of plugging things in. And this was no different. I just kind of put, okay, well, if we don't see any more new patients, any more new operative, and we just kind of cut back what we have. And of course that always ends up being better than you think. And so the idea was to find the right person, and we definitely did. And we couldn't be happier that way, but you talk to enough people, there's also like the horror stories that happen. And training's different than it was. I mean, she uses Isolite and everything, which is great. And I use Rubberdam because I'm apparently old and that's what happens. And we both are happy to do good quality work our own way, which is great.
Yeah, that seems to be a big, you could make another podcast out of that, but you're far from the first person I talked to where it's like, there's like this big dichotomy or this generational shift in the way pediatric dentistry is done. And it's like the old school, new school line. I don't know what year this happened, but I'm going to guess like 2015 to 17 or so, you know, because it's kind of right after I started. But, you know, everybody a few years before me, it's like rubber dam, lots of class 2 amalgams, it's complete caries removal, everything's traditional. And then you get a little bit more of a shift. Now it's like really shifted where it's like lots of hall crowns, lots of SDF, a lot of Isolite, a lot of just really alternative techniques. You know, there's right. just been such a change in the way that treatment planning is done that it does seem that it sets itself up to have a lot of headbutting with existing pediatric, established pediatric dentist bringing on a new associate. Like you definitely have to, both parties have to be open to good conversation and like good communication skills to make that relationship work, because the training is just so different than what it was.
It is.
Years ago.
And the results are good. That's all that matters. Right. And mm-hmm. I think it requires a lot of staff education too, because they just see one way is the only right way. In reality mm-hmm. is there's many ways to get good outcomes, and they're starting to see that. And when my staff members are bringing their kids to see the associate, that's a great sign that they have faith in her. So
that's cool.
It's a good feeling, but you know, it was something it's difficult to find, but it's worth talking to a lot of people. But
yeah. Brandon, I got two last little things to hit, and then we'll get back to our work here. So I wanted to touch on the American Board of Pediatric Dentistry. I didn't get a lot of time to look into this, but having just recently gone through the process of getting board certified and passing mm-hmm. boards this last year, what's been your role in that? I don't think I've ever had anybody on the podcast that's like been on the board or been like, I think I've had a few examiners, but I was just going to like, tell me about like your history with that. Cause I know you're fairly involved in some organized dentistry and that sort of thing, but sure. What's been your role with all that?
So the organization is the College of Diplomates of the American Board of Pediatric Dentistry. And there's some kind of naming challenges with that, but it's the organization that only allows members who are board certified to join our CE group. And so I'm not a part of the board proper in terms of, you know, setting up the ROC-P and the oral exams and that kind of thing. We do some remediation for people who don't pass on the first try to kind of help with that. But I'm not a part of, I've sat in board meetings because as a kind of a guest member, but that's about it. So
okay.
I can't say enough though about if you are interested in kind of smaller meetings, kind of more kind of positive, high quality destination with smaller meetings, the COD or the College of Diplomates is where it's at. I've been really happy with them. And then prior to that, I was on the regulatory side for the State Oregon Board of Dentistry, which does kind of handle, you know, licensure issues. And that could be a whole nother podcast, but it was really eye-opening to see the amount of things that general dentists at the state level who are per levying basically fines don't know about pediatric dentistry. And so I had to do a lot of pushback saying, no, this is actually appropriate care, or this is not appropriate care. And so that's kind of the kind of different kind of things I've been in. Now I'm focused more on private practice and management and my kids and all that.
Cool. Well, it's cool. It definitely sounds like you did your duty for public service and community dentistry and all that good stuff. So, and then, you know, as we are wrapping up, one of the final thoughts I wanted you to kind of reflect on, knowing that the audience is going to be a lot of younger dentists, is, you know, on the buy versus rent debate. I mean, you seem like you've had a similar path in your professional journey that I'm going on, where you do a startup and you lease to start. But it seems like now with higher interest rates, everything's so expensive that, it's hard for a new grad with a new startup to just go right out of the gate and start in either find a building or like build a building along with starting the practice, because it's just such a huge debt load when you don't have any patients and any cash flow. But obviously there's a lot of benefits to it. So I was just curious, like if you had any advice or reflection on if you had young pediatric dentists coming to you that were either in residency or new associates and wanted to become practice owners, how do you have that discussion with them on the, you know, start a scratch practice and lease the space out, or try to find an existing building and get into that and renovate it? Or, you know, what would be your current advice? How would you do things now if you were coming out as a new resident in 2023 with a stack of student loans in a more higher interest rate environment?
Yeah, you're right about that student loan environment. That is wild what you guys at the new grads have to deal with. One thing I would say is that there are literally hundreds and maybe thousands of really successful pediatric dentists who retire early and have a great financial life who never owned a building. And to be clear, if you're looking for a high standard of living in your 30s or early 30s, buying a building or buying a building may not be the best way to go about that. But if you're willing to, you know, save quite a bit more than you make early on and kind of have a plan, and, or kind of have financing kind of on the side somehow, it's going to make the end goal a little bit easier that way. And you don't get tenant improvements when you own your own building, cause it's just you. Right. So I think we all are trying to strive for, you know, college and dental school and residency and all like the next thing. I think it's a good thing to dispel the myth, particularly in some markets. Buying a building may not be the next thing. You can be really successful, and you can, particularly in this environment where landlords are hurting to find tenants, you have a lot more leverage than used to. And cost, looking at my costs from 2011, man, things have really gone. I got a deal now based on how things are now. So don't want to make people feel like they have to do this to consider themselves successful. You know, it's just not necessary.
Brandon, there's a funny meme I saw or a reel or something the other day that is a snapshot. And the person said, you know, my biggest financial mistake I ever made was like being in high school right after the great financial crisis. You know, I just laugh because it's like you see all these people doing really well. And it's like there's a sweet spot in there where you could, like, you know, if you could survive that and then buy cheap homes and real estate at low interest and pick up all these assets cheap. And, you know, so I always thought that was funny. But yeah, it's definitely a much tighter environment to do a startup now. And even 2020 versus when I started versus now, my practice would have been way more to build out than what it was. So it's definitely a struggle for young grads. But if anybody's interested in like either the Portland area or wants to come shadow or pick your brain or maybe wants to do a building, if you're open to it, do you have any good contact info they could get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I'm on IPEDO all the time. You probably just look me up there. Again, my first name, Brandon, last name, Schwint. My website address is kona-kids.com. And you can just kind of reach out and you can contact my team and they can get my contact info to you. My email is drbrandon@konakids.com, one word. So happy to chat with anyone. If they have any questions, DM me on Facebook. I'm on Instagram too. So happy to chat about things. And I think it's really important just to talk to as many people as possible before you kind of commit to big financial choices. I did that a lot and people kind of got annoyed with me, I'm sure, but I really get me out of making really big mistakes anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Doing some due diligence. But Brandon, I appreciate you taking the time and kind of trying something new and hopping on a podcast with me, but I enjoyed our chat and be happy to do it again sometime. It was fun.
Cheers. Thanks so much, Casey. Love the podcast.
All right. Thanks, Brandon. Have a good one. We'll see you.
Be well. All Take
right.
care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Bruise and Tiny Teeth podcast. Be sure to DM our host, Casey Getz, on social media with any listener questions, comments, or tough clinical situations. We'll see you next week for another unfiltered episode.